nothing to disclose, no relationships. So I'm going to try and target my remarks a little bit to asthma and diabetes and chronic diseases. Again, looking at what exactly are the roles of the certified health education specialists in these, and what credentialing out there? Should we get credentialed, not get credentialed? What is out there? So first, chronic disease projections, and why is this all important? So by 2025, the number of individuals living with diabetes is expected to increase from baseline of 2010 by 64%, costs by 72%. Asthma affects 43 million people, is projected to reach 50 million people by 2025. In 2005, there were 133 million Americans who had at least one chronic condition. In 2020, it's expected to grow to 157 million. Half of those people will have multiple chronic diseases. So why is that important? Most of the care is happening in primary care, which is what you would expect, right? But we're going to need a bigger workforce to take care of everybody with all these diseases, right? And we need a more integrated and interdisciplinary workforce, as well as everybody here today said, how do we pay for this? You know, and how's the reimbursement going to work? Again, you've seen this, but it has to be an integrated model. We spend, at least in primary care, a lot of the interpersonal and individual, but we also need to be able to, whether it's community health workers or whatever, get out more into what's going on in the community. So completing the puzzle, we've heard about ACA, we've heard about ACO, we've heard about PCMH, we've heard about community-centered health homes. We've heard about the need for an integrated team, and part of that team should be the health educator. Okay? And I can honestly tell you, when I bring this up in primary care, I say, why don't you hire a health educator to do the education? In the practice, it's what's a health educator? So I think part of what Rob is saying, and I agree with, is we need to sort of get out there and say, here's what we do, this is what we do, and why it's important, and here's what we do that other people don't do. Okay? I'm adding community health needs assessment, and the reason I use this slide again is because we're going to talk about that, but I see us as a bridge. Okay, I can honestly say I have worked in everything but government as part of my career. Okay, but I think we have a unique opportunity because part of what we do is get out there and talk to different groups to be able to be the bridge between all these groups as well. Okay, so we're going to talk about community health needs assessment. We're going to talk about where do we fit into health promotion, chronic disease management, opportunities as a certified diabetes educator, community health worker certification, asthma educator, health educator, health coach. There are so many opportunities, but they all have, it's like alphabet soup, right? We've got multiple names for the same thing. What do we know about literacy, and how can we help in patient education as part of that? Community outreach. I'm not going to talk much about clinical staffing and education, except that why not? Why shouldn't a health educator talk to clinical staff about how you use motivational interviewing and also how we can counsel better? And then our role as evaluation. Rob went over this slide, but it's just to point out that there are certain skills that a health educator has that other professions that are going to be asked to do similar work do not have. How do we promote the fact that we have these skills and others are not? So, community health needs assessment. I had the joy of doing Jefferson's community health needs assessment. Has anybody here done the community health needs assessment for a hospital? Okay, so you guys are going to be aware of this. So part of the PPACA was that hospitals, nonprofit hospitals, are now required to do a community health needs assessment every 3 years. And the good news is it has to be done by somebody who has public health background. That's good for us, okay? So you have to identify community needs. You have to develop an implementation plan that's going to address those needs. If you choose not to address something that is a need, you have to say why you have not, you plan not on doing that, okay? It has to go before the board of the hospital, the governing board. It's got to be approved. You then have to make it public. It should be on every hospital's website. You should be able to go and find out what exactly they said the issues were and what their plans are to do about it. And you also have to evaluate it. So lots of, I mean, like the perfect setup, right, for health education. I feel like for the first time in my career, I have job security. Okay? In fact, I have more than job security. All right. So what is community benefit? Improving access to health care, improving community health, education and research, relieving a government burden. That's one of the main keys. It can be charity care, but it's services designed to improve community health and access to care. So it's not marketing. Okay, and part of what I'm helping our marketing department do is that just because you sponsor a health fair doesn't mean that you have done community benefit. Okay, and this is a really difficult concept for hospitals to sort of get their arms around. Hospital organizations have to connect it, have to do this for every facility that they have. Okay, and you have to have separate implementation plans. That's how it's set up now. That may change in the future. So what are we doing? So you have to, not only do you have to use, you can go out and use data that already exists, but it says you must talk to people in your community. You must have to talk to stakeholders. You must talk to the community at large, the people who live in those neighborhoods, as to what they see their community needs as being. The implementation plan has to address those needs, and guess what? If you don't do this, you get fined $50,000 per facility that that hospital has. But the bigger news is why I have job security, okay, is that if a hospital loses their nonprofit status, that's a lot of money, much cheaper to pay Ricky and some staff in the Center for Urban Health than it is to lose our nonprofit status, okay? It has to get reported on the 990. You have to say what the needs are and, again, why you're not addressing them. So I'm going to skip this because it's kind of what you would, you have to talk about as part of your plan. You have to say, how did you decide what your community was going to be? How did you do the needs assessment exactly? How did you take into account the people in your community and make sure that you had input? And how did you go about prioritizing? So all this has got to be part of this community needs assessment and implementation plan. So this is kind of, you know, what it looks like. It's a nice model if you're looking for a model on how this all works. Secondary data review. We use a lot of Public Health Management Corporation's household health survey, which happens in Philly or southeastern Pennsylvania every 2 years. But I also use all of these to sort of make the case as what our, okay, and then the primary data was I did almost somewhere around 70, 75 interviews with people, focus groups with our employees, so we raised awareness that the hospital has to do this, and at the same time we talked to people who actually lived in those communities, so it was double duty. Looked at all kinds of things, but most importantly, one of the things that the CHNA requires is you have to look at social determinants of health. You must address social determinants of health. Now, did that happen the first go-through? From what I'm hearing, no. Hospitals kind of did the readmissions, looked at the emergency department. The next go-through, that's supposedly going to change. So we're looking for that sweet spot. What does our community say the needs are? What does the data tell us the needs are? And what resources do we have? And hopefully that's where our implementation plans will sit. Okay? Just for moving things along. So this is kind of like how we do things now, in parallel, in silos, right? We don't tend to share data or implementation plans or measurement plans. And what we want to go to is a model that's more combined, okay? So going forward, so right now the DHS or HHS in Philly is help, and what's sort of our hospital association is bringing people together to begin to look at how do we move to a model where the hospitals do these community health needs assessments together. We share data, we share information systems, how are we going to measure it, what are the indicators, and also how do we then link them to the fact that health departments have to do their accreditation. You know, if you're going to become accredited, you have to do a health needs assessment. Anybody who gets money from the government has to do a regular needs assessment in the community. How do we kind of get all in the same framework and stop doing separate ones and do needs assessments that we can combine? So, again, this is the future. What they're suggesting is the government wants to see more collaboration between institutions, more collaboration on the implementation plans, shared measurement across entities, and it's using the EHR. So what they're saying is, in the community-centered health home model, you know, as health educators, you know, we think about how do we get this data. Well, suppose somebody comes in and the physician says, so where did you get that broken arm? Which playground were you at? And we begin as part of the electronic medical records sort of saying, oh, okay, it was that playground. Then we can take that up to a community level and say, there's something wrong with that playground, okay, and do something about it. So how do we then integrate EHRs into that whole thing? That's CHNAs. Health education specialists and primary cares, Rob alluded to this article, and I'm going to take you through it because I think it's a really unique opportunity. And quite frankly, when I got my MPH, this is what I thought I was going to do. Only it didn't exist. So I'm hoping that my students will have the opportunity to really do this. Okay? So the question is, if think about primary care. What they're looking at doing is, let's train nurses to do health education. Let's take our MAs and train them to also do health education. So what we should be saying is, and that, what this group said, this was American Association of Family Practice. Okay, and instead of doing the usual route, they said, let's use health educators. And they actually have a return on investment as part of this, too. So how does a health educator fit into this? Okay, and why should we use it? Well, we have all the criteria already. You'd have to train nurses. Okay, the idea of practicing to the top of your license, right? Nurses should be doing primary care. Docs should be doing primary care. MAs should be doing what MAs do. And you need somebody who can actually fill that gap and do the health education. So health educator roles, health coach roles, and quality coordinator, right? Practices have populations. What are we good at? We're really good at assessing populations. So how do we take those skills and sell them to primary care? Okay, we can already do these kinds of things that they're looking for. The training, bachelor's or master's degree in public health, this is what they used in this particular practice. Health coaching certification, there's some groups out there that are actually doing that type of credentialing. There is no national credentialing for that, however. And again, CHES, MCHES, particularly MCHES, is really well qualified to look at a practice and say, oh, you know, geez, your diabetics aren't, you know, under control, here's some interventions that we can do, and here's how it's going to work. So here's what they actually did. The health education specialist participates in the initial exam. They spend 45 minutes. The doc spent 15 minutes, okay, and they charge $156 to $165 for that visit, okay? And it's basically assessing where you are, asking you questions about your health, right? Same thing happens at the annual wellness visit. And during the preventive exam, it's going to work on, you know, coaching and wellness and all those kinds of things that we want, you know, what behaviors do you need to change. At the annual wellness visit, health education specialist spends an hour. The doc spends 2 hours to document what just happened, and you get to charge a lot of money for it, right? Subsequent annual wellness visits, same idea, okay? Health coaching. This happens after you call. You know, how many calls are you going to make? You're going to make 4 to 8 minutes with each patient. You document it. We become scribes to help the physician get things into the medical record. You spend about 30 minutes a week making phone calls. And again, that's a lesser payment. So these are kind of some of the roles that they used. And what they found is if a health educator, I guess the average was something around $47,000, okay, based on that. The health educator did three people a day and three phone calls a day, they would make $54,000 in a year and cover the cost of the health educator. So this idea of return on investment is really key, I think, to how are these things going to get paid in the future. And this was basically, you can see what happened at each of the appointments. Okay. I'm going to go for it. So that's how do we integrate ourselves into primary care, okay? I actually shared this article with Jefferson's Family Medicine Practice, okay? So where I'm hoping, I mean, I've said this other times, but I'm hoping that the article kind of pushes them to sort of say, gee, maybe we really should think about health educators. 2 minutes? Oh, I'll go real fast. No, I won't get through it. Community health workers. They're called everything under the sun, okay? There's currently no national certification or credentialing at all for that, but it's moving towards sort of national recommendations. Sherry Ludi and I sat in on sort of the group that was working on that. Again, CHW roles, I think, you know, have kind of gone over. The labor definition of it does not include health educators. Important to know that. They are frontline workers. I'm going to skip a lot of this because you kind of know it. I think the bottom line is a health educator, whether or not you actually need to become a community health worker, but it may be that that's how you get paid. So that might be why you want to get a certification, in that the states are all have different ways that they're looking at this. And training's all over the place, 80 to 160 hours. Some need exams, some don't need exams. Some of it is, you know, you need additional credits. Some you don't need additional credits. There's grandfathering anywhere between, if you've worked 1,000 to 4,000 hours, you can be a CHW. So it's really, in terms of criteria, all over the place. National Asthma Education Certification Board. CHW, or somebody who's got a degree in health education, if you're a CHES, you can sit for this exam. You might want to get certified as an asthma educator. Might be a really good thing if you want to do primary care or work between primary care and the community. So that might be something that you would be interested in. Diabetes educator, Sophie worked really hard to get MCHES certified for this. Usually what they require is you have a license. In this case, since we don't get licenses, we will be able to sit for the exam. You have to meet the same criteria, though, that others would. It's 1,000 hours working with the group, continuing education. But that will also allow us to get paid, because that's how you get paid, is if you have to be certified. Patient navigators, no state or national accreditation at this time, but there are people who have begun working on what this should look like at a national level. Lung Association's got a certified tobacco treatment specialist. There are fitness specialists. Again, this you might think about, is particularly if you wanted to work in primary care or in worksite. National Wellness, I'm going to end with this. This is my last slide. But what they talk about is who can become a wellness in clinical practice, right? They don't include health education specialists as part of that. They include massage therapists, they include PTs, they include naturopaths, but they do not include health education specialists. And I actually think this is an area that would be good to do, not only for clinical practice, but also if we're thinking about working in maybe worksite.
Thank you very much, Ricky. Okay. Well, now's your chance. We have 4 experts here that have talked about everything from getting familiar with the payment systems and the rubric used, all the way through to what are the roles and the skills, the knowledge that health educators have that can be applied, that are being done. One example in the state health system, and Ricky talked more specifically about community clinical linkage and her experience in hospital needs assessments and the various other certifications that are available to us as health educators. So, questions? Jody.
It's a great question.
It's a
what's a proposed regulation,
proposed,
right?
So we can comment.
Yeah. So we need to come. We need to right. Exactly, Rob. We need to place a comment on it. And Elaine, I think that's something we should be doing with SOFI as a national organization, so we can lodge our comments. It's also, we have to keep in mind the future. So CMS, even today's proposed regs, and they're still very oriented towards the fee for service. Okay, so it permits, but ultimately the payments, we have to focus, remember, on that bundle. Mm-hmm. What's really going to happen in 3 years when lung cancer screenings are just part of a bundle of the wellness reimbursement. And so how do health educators fit in that, in the circle that is that. But thank you for that, for raising that. I think we'll certainly follow up on Sophie's end.
Yeah, I think there has been a broader initiative, too, to try to educate those at CMS about what is the role of health education specialists and, you know, where do we fit into their bigger picture that they may not have thought of. So we've started last year. Kara James was here doing a presentation, so we've with the Office of Minority Health, so I think she's very much aware of that, what role we can play. But all of you play an essential role because not only from the national level, but you're at the state level. You have to deal with your state Medicaid agencies and opportunities to work there and in being part of that the team that's recognized and can be reimbursed. I think we had a question over here first.
Yeah.
Really big question. I don't know if it was.
I think for us in Minnesota, we're just a little concerned about the possible elimination of the prevention fund. I think that they may go after that first, and that's why where I alluded in my presentation that we really need to make sure with the Affordable Care Act, participating if it's APA, your local affiliate of your public health association, if you have a SOFI chapter, if you're connected with the American Heart Association, or any of those voluntary health organizations to make sure that that's on their radar and that's on their docket to as part of their legislative platform. And I think it's also important for all of you to talk to your elected officials about this because, you know, it's got to come from you, and you need to be able to discuss it with them as well. But we're in Minnesota. That's one of the things that we're worried about. That's going to be first.
If I could just add to that APHA actually is very concerned as well, and the protecting the prevention of public health fund is a top priority of APHA through its various arms. And when you get your emails from the
Government relations,
or through your, Connect, APHA Connect, please respond to them. Really, I plead to you to click that link and respond so that you stay strong.
Can I just quickly mention, not so much about that, we also have a Supreme Court, we're going to be hearing it sometime in June, and that certainly would impact the funding mechanisms and stuff. But I just want to mention about what else we can do at the state and local level. If you're near your regional office of HHS, you have a CMS person there in your local. So we have CMS in Philadelphia as the regional headquarters, so we need to go and talk to and connect with them. But certainly at your state level, your managed care, talking about Medicaid, your managed care organizations, as they move away from fee-for-service, those are the groups of people you really want to talk with and get connected with at a direct level in your state, if we possibly can.
Question back there.
I'm in charge, I'm in charge, I meet with patients for a few minutes, but then I turn.
My only thought is the categories listed are under physician supervision in some form. So in other words, you can't have a nurse practitioner under a physician who's not being supervised. So the or versus the and will imply two visits versus the or, which will mean someone can go to the nurse practitioner whose authority alone, or a health educator whose authority alone can send someone for screening.
I also think that it's also within the state. So when a physician refers to a non-physician provider, such as a health educator, you can do that, and that's legal. It's where the reimbursement comes in. And so if your state doesn't allow for health educators to be reimbursed under Medicaid or Medicare, then that's a problem, and then that's where you need to, and each state's a little bit different, and then that's where you need to go and talk and work with your Medicaid office for that reimbursement. So then what you need to do then, because then you're getting dollars in, you need to talk to your powers to be of your health, your clinic or your health system, in that, okay, so then the health educator becomes a facility or a resource, and that's all part of the cost of that care. Right, right. But, I mean, it's still legal. It's just that then your organization just needs to think about that.
Nationally.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah.
We're going to quote you on that,
yeah,
too.
So and I agree with you.
Yes, yes.
And that's what Ricky said, is everybody works at the top of their license.
Yes.
And so
yes,
even in Minnesota, when we went from healthcare homes and that whole transformation, that's probably one of the hardest things for the team to figure out, is how do you work at the top of your license, and for physicians to give up some control and feel comfortable that the health educator or nurse, you know, whoever's doing the work is going to be doing the work. But once they get it and once they do it, then they... So maybe you need to be presenting at the Academy of Family
Physicians,
and because it needs to come from the provider, a peer to peer, to say, hey, this is how.
Well, we're training the young physicians.
Oh, yeah. Well, there
that's
you go.
Too.
So we're
we have a question back here too. In the last couple of minutes, I think I saw some. Okay. Okay. Well, please join me in thanking all of our presenters today. I know you will be able to access all their presentations through the APHA website. All of them have been loaded up. The session has been recorded. So for your future reference and sharing what you learned today with others back home in your state's communities, practices, we hope you will be inspired to take it to the next level and have a critical role for the health education professional in completing the puzzle for ACA. So thank you.